Radio presents Crime Pays, a look at who's getting rich from the prison boom.
Corrections has become a huge industry. It's become, in most of our states, the largest single budget item.
The American prison system has become a source of great wealth for the private sector. Among the beneficiaries are telephone companies.
It's a $1 billion-a-year market, unquestionably so.
Food and clothing vendors, security systems, weapons manufacturers, building construction, and private prisons.
I think most people don't know that private prisons exist.
If we build it, they will come.
As long as they keep those beds full, they're happy.
And the industry promised that, hey, we can do things differently.
But has the private sector had a positive impact on prisoners and the prison system? I'm Joanne Marr. In the next hour, we'll see how and why the prison system has become a growth industry for private contractors and what this means for the rest of us. Abu Ghraib was probably the best-known example of recent private contractor involvement in U.S.-run prisons.
There are new photos and new videos coming.
He twisted a loose wire around the finger of a blindfolded prisoner.
Other images show soldiers acting inappropriately with a dead body.
Failure in leadership, sir. Lack of discipline. No training whatsoever.
Were the abuses the work of a few bad apples in the U.S. military?
The collars used on prisoners, the dogs, and the cameras did not suddenly appear out of thin air.
The American public was surprised to learn that private contractors had conducted the interrogations at Abu Ghraib. Americans might also be surprised to learn how deeply private contractors have been involved in the U.S. prison system over the last 20 years. Prisons are now a multi-billion-dollar industry for the private sector. It's part of the privatization wave that swept the country and that's now transformed today's prison industry. Among the biggest beneficiaries of government contracts are private prison companies. The prisons they own and operate don't attract a lot of attention. They're usually tucked away in the backwoods, off lonely stretches of highway. Private prisons are part of a lucrative growth area that's represented a bonanza for the private sector. 30 years ago, prisons were not taken seriously as a big money-making venture. Today, the private sector reaps billions of dollars from the prison industry. Never before has it been possible to get so rich by incarcerating other people. Nowhere is such wealth more evident than here in New Orleans at the annual American Correctional Association Conference. The ACA is the largest private correctional association in the country. Its trade shows attract private prisons as well as corporate vendors who have profited greatly selling goods and services to prisoners and the prison industry.
I mean, I guess if more people are in prison, there's going to be a bigger demand, but that's not up to us.
Companies like Western Union.
We move money fastest worldwide.
Point Blank Body Armor.
We sell ballistic vests, spike vests, edge weapon plates.
L'Oreal Soft Sheen.
Our products are hair care products designed for the Afro-American market.
Speed Queen, washer and dryers.
We have a 60-pound washer here today where they wash a lot of sheets, towels at the same time.
The CM Security Group.
That's why you need steel like this. No one will get out.
National Foods USA.
Everybody eats candy. Prisoners are no different. They like candy as a treat, just like people do on the outside.
I was at a federal prison in New Jersey that had 16 vending machines. The facility has 4,000 inmates, and they said those vending machines are refilled daily.
Herb Holter works with prisoners in his capacity as director of NCIA, the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives.
When you go to American Correctional Association Conference, you have the barbed wire vendors, you have the stun gun vendors, you have the telephone vendors, you have the vending machine franchises, and you'll find very little talk about what programs might be more effective or how we can better manage our populations. It's all about what the industry is doing. And corrections has become a huge industry. It's become, in most of our states, the largest single budget item in the state budget.
How did the growth in corrections spending happen? It started over 20 years ago as the prison population began rising rapidly.
We live in a country now that has the highest incarceration rate in the civilized world.
NCIA Director Herb Holter.
The incarceration rate in the United States is, for the last 5 or 6 years, has been in the top three in the world, along with South Africa and Russia. We incarcerate now at a rate of over 600 per 100,000 citizens, and no other European country comes anywhere near that.
In the early 1980s, there were no private prisons, and the total U.S. prison population was around 500,000. Today, the population now stands at over 2 million prisoners, a 400% increase. The reason for the big jump? Americans got tough on crime.
Police Department, search warrant, demand entry!
When the crime rate went up in the 60s, the government reacted by jailing more offenders. Even when the crime rate went back down in the 90s, the prison population continued its meteoric rise. The public sphere of crime escalated as media coverage of crime stories increased.
One North Bay neighborhood, four separate sexual assaults. What police know about their suspect?
I mean, there's no doubt that crime occurs, and there's no doubt that, you know, what we all want are safer communities. But I do think that you have people living in extremely safe communities.
Rose Braz is director of Critical Resistance, an activist organization seeking to roll back the prison industry.
But if you read the paper, you watch the TV, you look at America's Most Wanted, you watch cops, you are inundated with this image of people jumping out behind bushes at every turn. And I do think it instills a disproportionate fear of crime in people who are very unlikely to be the victims of crime.
Tough on crime became a popular platform for politicians. Penalties for drug possession were increased. Mandatory minimum sentences were established. In the 1990s, many states adopted three strikes and truth in sentencing laws, requiring offenders to serve 85% of their sentences. The end result? Longer sentences and an explosion in the prison population.
Will you wait for me while I do my time? Will you wait for me for 99?
As the number of prisoners increased, states could not keep up with the expansion. Judy Green, a criminal justice policy analyst, says the prison population boom led to serious overcrowding problems.
States were quick to pass get-tough laws, but slow to appropriate the kind of money that was needed to build prisons to take care of the overflow.
Stepping in to fill the breach was CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America, one of the country's first private prison companies. Policy analyst Judy Green says CCA's timing was fortuitous. In the early 80s, the concept of privatizing government services was starting to take hold.
So by the early 90s, the market was emerging. We had a new administration of fiscal conservatives and free market pro-business in Washington, D.C. The Reagan administration was pushing the idea of privatization and reinventing government and shrinking government. And so for some key entrepreneurs with excellent connections to the Republican Party, people who'd been very busy privatizing hospitals looked at this new market and got the idea that some of the techniques that they'd been applying to privatizing health care could be applied to privatizing corrections.
In the past, when prisons got overcrowded, states could always fall back on parole and early release programs to keep the population down. Tough on crime laws eliminated parole and early release for the most part. CCA and other private prison companies helped absorb the overflow and thus played a key role in accommodating the prison population expansion. Scott Marquardt is president of the private prison company Management Training Corporation and spokesperson for a consortium of private prisons. Marquardt says the private sector can build prisons cheaply and more quickly.
We can frequently design, build a facility, and from start to finish have a facility open in 12 to 18 months. When the public does it to go through all of the approval processes, generally they've taken over 3 years. We've been able to do it much quicker, and we've also been able to save a lot of money.
No running on the yard. No running on the yard.
Today, private prisons house 6 to 7% of the entire U.S. prison population. Most of the private prisons are located in the South and are concentrated in states like Texas, Oklahoma, Mississippi, and Georgia. 30 years ago, a lot of people would have said, not in my backyard. But these days, private prisons have been welcomed by small towns and communities hard hit by recession.
Attention all units, counts clear, time 11:43.
The Leo Chesney Center is a minimum security prison for women owned by Cornell Corrections. It's located in the town of Live Oak, 50 miles north of Sacramento, California. Live Oak is a rural town with no major industries and high unemployment. When the private prison project was first proposed in the late 1980s, Live Oak residents were evenly divided.
In the early days, the prison was like, no, not in my backyard.
Dennis Loftus was a produce delivery driver before he got hired as a prison guard at the Leo Chesney Center.
The word prison puts in mind of escapees, people breaking out and doing harm stuff, and, you know, ignorance, not knowing. That's what they were afraid of. People are always afraid of the unknown. Now they know what it's about, and they're not afraid of it no more. In fact, they like it. We do a lot for this community.
The prison is now the town's largest employer and enjoys widespread popularity among its residents. A few years ago, the state threatened to shut down Leo Chesney, but town residents rallied to keep it open. Charles Eggert, former mayor of Live Oak, says the prison plays a critical role in the town's economy.
Each day they have what they call an outside crew that comes outside of the facility and takes care of public grounds in terms of cutting lawn, edging, planting, landscaping. They cut weeds out of vacant lots to take the fire hazard out. What they do basically in terms of public service and for the city of Live Oak itself is roughly $300,000 a year or more that we would have to pay someone to do if we hired them to do so. The ladies come out, it would take 5 men to replace them for what they do on a daily basis.
10,000 miles away, 10,000 miles away, I am dreaming of my child 10,000 miles away.
The prisoners at Leo Chesney come from all over California, hundreds of miles away from their families. At other private facilities, out-of-state prisoners are often housed thousands of miles away from their homes. The town of Florence sits in the middle of the Arizona desert along Highway 79. As soon as you enter the town, the first thing you notice is row after row of prison barracks, surrounded by barbed wire fences and guard towers. Florence has 3 private prisons. Before the arrival of the private prisons, Florence was a town in sad shape.
When I took over, I had 13 cars. 3 of them ran. I had 3 motorcycles and none of them ran.
Tom Rankin has worn many different hats over the years. He was on the Florence Town Council, he was interim town council manager, and in the 80s, he was the police chief.
The town's financial situation was not in good shape. When I was chief of police, at the gas station here, I had one station that would allow us to have credit for 2 weeks at a time. The employees here were getting just above minimum wage. The fire station was right next door to the police department. And we kept one of the older truck, we kept it on an incline so that, if the battery didn't start, we could pop the clutch and roll it down and pop the clutch. It's funny now. It wasn't funny then because we in the service knew that we were in trouble and we had to get something to improve on it.
Tell me, where are we?
Okay, now we're going into the fire department.
Tom Rankin is giving a tour of Florence's brand new fire department.
Is the chief available?
Thanks to government money generated by the 3 private prisons, the fire department is state-of-the-art. It has a fully equipped gymnasium, brand new fire trucks and equipment, kitchen facilities, and full staffing.
We have a 24-hour-a-day medic service now that we never had before with EMTs and IEMTs and paramedics, right?
Correct.
And you see, they've got their easy chairs, and they've got their table, and they're all the amenities of home are right here. There's a lot of towns bigger than us that would love to have our facility, but they don't have it because they don't have that private prison now or that money coming in. That's true.
In addition to the fire department, Florence now has a brand new police department, a new park, a new senior center, and a newly renovated city hall. These new buildings were bought and paid for by the extra state and federal funding that's come in. With the additional prisoners from the three private prisons, Florence's total population has nearly tripled. The government's funding formula is based on the census count, which includes prisoners, even though they're not permanent residents. Florence now has the peculiar distinction of having the highest percentage of prisoners of any town with a population over 10,000, thanks to the private prisons.
Did we luck out? Yeah. You bet we lucked out. Are we glad to have them? You bet we're glad to have them. Do we want more? We got more land. Bring them on out here.
I'm back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend.
You're listening to Crime Pays, a look at who's getting rich from the prison boom. A radio documentary on prison privatization. I'm Joanne Marr.
Riding the reins once more. Toting my old 44.
Prison towns like Florence and Live Oak have been the beneficiaries of taxpayer dollars going into their communities. But how are taxpayers benefiting from private prisons? Privatization advocates repeat the same mantra continuously. Government is wasteful and inefficient, and the private sector can do the job better at less cost. Private prison spokesperson Scott Marquardt.
There have been a number of studies that have been conducted to measure that, over 20, and on average, these studies have shown that the operational costs are less when private companies operate a correctional facility by 5 to 15%. And if the private company is involved in the design and construction of the facility, studies have shown that the savings are in the range of 15 to 25%. So when you add that up over the number of facilities we're talking about billions of dollars in savings.
Other studies dispute private prisons' claims of cost savings. The federal government's General Accounting Office issued a report in 1996, which found little or no difference in the operational costs between private and public prisons. In Colorado, State Representative Buffy McFadden has questioned claims of cost savings for many months. Colorado is projecting an increase in its prison population, and the state legislature seems ready to add more private prisons. The problem, says McFadden, is that Colorado has never done an audit to determine whether private prisons have actually saved the state any money.
Currently, Colorado is paying just under $50 a day per inmate to our private facilities. The state prison, which is 7 miles away, Arkansas Valley Correctional Facility, the average per cost per inmate is $66.02 per day. What I do not know as a state legislator, and what I'm hoping to get the answer to, is how much does the state also pay, aside from the $50 a day, how much are we paying for medical costs for inmates, transportation of inmates, case management of inmates, monitoring units, how much are we paying for clothing, how much are we paying for training of the private prison employees, how much are we paying for riot control, and how much are we paying for inmate recovery?
So, who's doing a better job running prisons? And who's saving more money? It's hard to say. Comparing private and public prisons is a bit like comparing apples and oranges. Studies comparing the two reach different conclusions, depending on who's funding the research. Dennis Burke is chief of staff for Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano, a critic of private prisons. Arizona is a state with a lot of private prisons. Although they appear to cost less, Burke says that outward appearances can be deceptive.
As evident in Arizona, private prisons will only take lower offenders. Like we've seen in healthcare, quite often the state is left with the sicker of our citizens to take care of in our health system, and in our prison system, we are required to take care of the most dangerous ones, and their record can look good because they're dealing only with the less dangerous offenders.
70% of all private prisons are minimum security. housing low-level offenders. Most of the hardcore, violent felons are housed in state prisons and supermaxes. Despite these differences, many private prisons share the same problems that plague government-run prisons: riots, gang violence, physical and sexual abuse. Arizona had shipped out 600 convicts to a private prison in Texas, hoping to save money. Instead, the transaction ended up costing Arizona taxpayers over $400,000. In January 2003, prisoners staged hunger strikes and riots over poor conditions and lack of food. The governor's chief of staff, Dennis Burke, says the prison company, Correctional Services Corporation, had violated the contract.
We've had difficulties with that prison in Newton, Texas. Our Department of Corrections has had to go back time and time again, not only conduct thorough audits, but also to request that the prison provide the amenities and services that they contended they would provide in their contract. It shows the difficulties that we face in transporting prisoners out of state, and it also shows the private prisons industry's push to cut costs at the risk of public safety.
To maximize profits, many private prisons cut corners and services. Most private prisons save money and lower staff salaries and less guard training. In California, private prison guards make as little as $9 to $10 an hour.
Next thing I'm going to hand out to you, this is a flyer, and it's printed by the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Does anybody know who they are?
This instructor is giving a training class to new guards at a private prison in McFarland, California, owned by Wackenhut Corrections.
Anybody?
Rodney Hall is the state monitor assigned to McFarland.
Well, I would say that the training that these particular people get is nowhere near as extensive as those in the Department of Corrections. The folks that work here, they get their week of training in a approved academic correctional setting, whereas to a person who works in the Department of Corrections is mandated to his 16 weeks of training, plus all the OJT training he's getting while on the job.
Prison guard turnover rate is 3 to 4 times higher at private prisons nationwide. The high turnover rate tends to result in guards with less experience. And in volatile situations, lack of experienced guards can lead to disastrous results. Lance Corcoran is executive director of CCPOA, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association. In the event of a prison riot or other outbreak that threatens public safety, Corcoran says private prison guards are not qualified to handle such emergencies.
For instance, Eagle Mountain, when the riot erupted, I guess it was about a year ago, and the inmate was killed, the staff literally left the facility. They called for help from the public facilities, which were about 50 miles away, and Centinela State Prison, as well as Calipatria State Prison, sent response teams over to quell the riot.
One of the worst outbreaks happened in 1998 at a CCA prison in Youngstown, Ohio. Like a lot of economically depressed cities, Youngstown badly needed the jobs CCA could bring in. What it didn't need was the violent felons CCA brought in from Washington, D.C.
They had lied to the community continuously. They had been having numerous problems at that facility, and we kept bringing them to light, and they would brush them off, and nobody would listen to us.
Tim Schaefer is a union president in Ohio, representing 10,000 corrections workers.
Oh, they had problems like stabbings, large number of assaults. An inmate was killed up there. Classification problems. They were told they were only medium security inmates, and there was actually maximum security inmates in the facility that should not have been mixed in. So it was a real serious security threat.
The mayor is warning the city's 100,000 residents to remain on high alert until the fugitives are found.
Youngstown's problems continue to escalate when six prisoners escaped. Four of them were convicted murderers. Union President Tim Schaefer says the city was thrown into a complete state of panic.
These six inmates actually cut through the fence because the alarm system on the fence was not working. It was known by the inmates. They activated the state of Ohio special response teams to go out searching for the inmates, the sheriff's departments, the highway patrol, all this at the taxpayers' expense, and CCA never did pick up the tab there.
Investigations into the Youngstown debacle reveal that lack of experience guards was a major contributing factor. 80% of the guards had never worked in a prison before and were completely unprepared for the violent D.C. inmates. The Youngstown scandal generated a lot of bad publicity for CCA. The company's stock was riding high in the early 90s, but after Youngstown, CCA's stock plunged to 50 cents a share, and the company nearly went bankrupt. You're listening to Crime Pays, a look at who's getting rich from the prison boom, a radio documentary on prison privatization. I'm Joanne Marr. Coming up, the expansion of private sector involvement in the prison industry and the forces organized in opposition. In the late 1990s, high-profile escapes, riots, and sexual assaults took place in Texas, Louisiana, and New Mexico private prisons. Investigations after these incidents consistently cited lack of experienced staff and high turnover as contributing factors. Given these problems, it's difficult for private prisons to claim superiority over government-run prisons. What's the rationale for funding them?
Money makes the world go round, go round. Money makes the go round, that clinking, clanking sound of money.
Private prisons owe their existence to political connections and influence peddling. Edwin Bender is executive director of the Institute on Money and State Politics. He did research into private prison campaign contributions and found that companies gave nearly $2 million in state races during the 1998 and 2000 election cycles. Bender says campaign contributions went to Democrats and Republicans alike.
It was whoever was in power in the legislature at the time. They will favor the winners, the incumbents, the people who can help them get their business decision made. And I want to emphasize, these are business decisions. These guys are investing their campaign dollars in candidates that they think can help them make something happen for the benefit of their bottom line.
The key players with the power to procure contracts are the high-powered lobbyists hired by private prison companies. Because no disclosure is required, researcher Edwin Bender says it's impossible to know how much these lobbyists are getting paid. Bender says the influence of lobbyists is enormous.
The private prisons industry hires some of the best lobbyists in the states, some of the highest paid. And those lobbyists know the ins and outs of their legislatures. They're not doing anything illegal. They're doing what lobbyists do. But they are out there every day. It is their job to try to ensure that their clients' wishes are met. And average Joe does not have that ability. He cannot guard his taxpayer money the way a lobbyist can go after that money for the private prisons companies.
That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round.
In addition to lobbyists, private prison companies have ex-prison officials on their payroll. Researcher Edwin Bender says the presence of these former officials gives private prisons a great advantage in procuring government contracts.
I do know that the private prison industry hires former government officials on a fairly regular basis. Those guys will go from a state prison to a private corporation, and then they'll get hired by another state to run their corrections department and then go back. There's a revolving door, and I don't think that's any different than any other industry.
Typical example example of that was when the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Mike Quinlan, retired. He went to work as first a consultant and then an official at CCA.
Criminal Justice Policy Analyst Judy Green.
During the period that he was head of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, he was not in favor of privatizing the federal prisons. Once he left government and went to CCA, he realized suddenly what a good idea this was, what the benefits were. And not too long after his joining CCA, the Bureau of Prisons started putting out requests for proposals for new private prisons.
Hiring lobbyists, ex-politicians, and ex-prison officials is legal. However, some recent hires have raised eyebrows. In New Mexico, the private prison company Wackenhut Corrections hired Senate President Pro Tem Manny Aragon to be its lobbyist. Aragon held on to his Senate post while lobbying for Wackenhut. Bruce Kane is director of the Institute for Government Studies at UC Berkeley. Kane says while Aragon's dual jobs may be technically legal, they present serious ethical problems.
The sitting official has the ability to log roll, has the ability to hold up the corrections officials' budget if they're not going to comply with what the company wants. I mean, there are just a lot of reasons why an elected official shouldn't be lobbying on behalf of a company that does business with the state. I think it impairs the judgment of the elected official. Instead of making decisions that are in the best interest of the state, the elected official is going to make decisions and influence others to make decisions based on this business relationship they have. And that seems to me to be a prescription for disaster.
Critics say the power the private prison industry wields goes beyond lobbyists and government contracts. They accuse companies of promoting the tough-on-crime policies that have spurred prison growth. Private prison spokesperson Scott Marquardt denies the industry has lobbied for or against any legislation.
We have never engaged in any lobbying in any state to impact sentencing decisions or decisions on who should go to jail. That, I think, would be a conflict for us to get in that debate. It's not something we participate in. That's a decision for the government to make in terms of mandatory minimum sentencing guidelines or anything like that. We do not ever participate in that debate.
It turns out they didn't have to go to state capitol and publicly lobby for these bills. They were simply quietly sitting in hotel rooms writing these bills along with legislators who then took them home, introduced them, and got them passed.
Research analyst Judy Green says these bill-writing efforts were all made possible through ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC is a conservative public policy organization with great influence in Washington. ALEC brings together corporations and politicians, and with their help, drafts and promotes model legislation. Judy Green.
For many, many years, the co-chair of ALEC's Criminal Justice Task Force, an organization which was behind and pushing hard at the state level through the 90s for three strikes, you're out, for mandatory drug laws, for truth in sentencing, you know, offenders having to serve 85% of their sentences, all of these laws that helped to grow the prison boom. Until very recently, the vice president of the task force that created and pushed those laws at the state level was a high-level executive of CCA.
The growth of the prison system has produced new opportunities for the private sector. Private prison companies are now operating halfway houses and juvenile detention centers in addition to government prisons. Telephone companies like MCI, AT&T, and SBC have gained new customers from the prison expansion.
Operator, won't you put me on through? I gotta send my love down to Baton Rouge. Hurry up, won't you put her on the line? I gotta talk to the girl just one more time.
It's $1 billion a year market for the telecommunications carriers, unquestionably so.
Charles Carbone is an attorney with California Prison Focus. a nonprofit that defends the rights of prisoners.
So we're talking about the largest prison populations in the world. And as a consequence, it's no surprise that these family members are trying to communicate with their loved ones on a regular basis when there are connection fees of $3 alone just to connect the call, much less the permanent charges, which can be 30 cents a minute, 40 cents a minute, 50 cents a minute. You take all these nickels and dimes, and quite quickly, they add up to millions and quite literally billions of dollars. So this is a $1 billion-a-year industry.
In California, a collect call from the local county jail costs 7 times as much as a 50-cent payphone call. The families who end up paying for the collect calls are among the poorest people who can least afford them. Prison rights attorney Charles Carbone.
An average phone bill can be $100 or more. I know family members that have bills of $300 or $350 a month. And these are economically disadvantaged communities and family members. So that represents a large portion of that family member's monthly income. And it really becomes a question of, do I talk to my loved one? Do I console them in prison? Do I keep them up to date on the events of their family or their children or their grandparents or their parents? Or do I decide that I can't afford it, that that's too costly? And that is a situation and an ethical dilemma or financial dilemma that no family member should be asked to make.
Keep trucking, got my chips,
Millions are made every year in the prison transportation business as well. 15 years ago, the inmate hauling industry barely existed. Today, increasing numbers of prisoners are being transported from state to state.
I believe in one of my articles I wrote that there are more regulations on transporting cattle across state lines than there are in transporting inmates.
Alex Friedman is a former private prisoner and now a reporter for Prison Legal News. He's researched and written articles on prison transportation and what's required to start your own business.
Well, you need a van, and in many cases, very little else. There are some literally mom-and-pop companies that have sprung up that transport inmates in their own van. And you just weld a big wire mesh across the front, and you buy a bunch of handcuffs. And in some cases, it is more, you know, stringent than that. You do have to have some kind of certification before you can do it. There is very little regulation in that regard. And as a result of that, there have been some pretty egregious incidents.
When I boarded, the first thing that I remember was the smell of urine. It was just rank. People had not bathed for days on end. Some men had been on the van for a week with no bath.
This was just the beginning of Robin Derbyshire's nightmare aboard a private transport van. Robin had been arrested on a forgery charge in Nevada and was being transported back to Colorado to face trial. The journey should have taken 18 hours. Instead, it stretched out over 4 days. The van went all over the West Coast, picking up and dropping off other prisoners. The driver of the van was Richard, an ex-prison guard who'd been fired for assaulting an inmate in Texas.
At first, I thought he was just being flirtatious, even though he was being very obnoxious. So I tried to ignore it. When we picked up Rosalinda in Los Angeles, my antennas went up, and I thought, something is not right here. At the point when he started saying he wanted to take us out in the desert, rape, shoot us, and leave us for dead in the Mojave Desert, and we're going through the Mojave Desert, I began questioning if there was a raging maniac in the van with us. And it just started escalating. It got worse and worse and worse. And then as we neared Mexico, I was having panic attacks. As we pulled into the roadside park, they left me in the van. He came back and got me, and I felt uncomfortable. I could just sense his demeanor had changed. And he walked me in. He made me go into the restroom. At that point, he started taking off my belly chains and my box cuff, and he said, "You're going to have sex with me." And I said, "No, I'm not." Then he mentioned to me, "Well, if you say anything, I'm going to shoot you. If you try to scream, I'll shoot you and say that you tried to escape." At that point, I got so angry that I started calling him a pig, and it seemed like it just made him more excited being called names. I mean, all I did was call him a pig, and at that point, he told me to lay down on the floor. He started unzipping his pants. He made me take the top and my bra off, and I laid down. And he stepped on my hand to the point I felt like he was crushing it. And I closed my eyes, and I remember him coming over to the side of me and trying to squat down, but he was too heavy. He did at one point make me pull my skirt down, and I didn't know what else to do. I was in a position where I thought, well, I can't do anything. What am I going to do? I don't know if he's going to shoot me, because the more I tried to fight him, the more he got violent. And I just gave in and did what I was told.
When the van finally arrived in Colorado, Robin reported the assault to the van company and to the state. No action was taken against the driver, but Robin refused to quit. Eventually, she contacted the American Civil Liberties Union, which filed a lawsuit against the van company. The lawsuit was settled, with the company agreeing to pay Robin a substantial amount.
It wasn't about money. It was about what was right. I was embarrassed. I was very ashamed. But in my mind, I thought the only way to bring it to light is to speak up. With so many victims, they've been silenced. They've been intimidated to not speak, or an issue gets pushed under the rug. I didn't crack one bit. I stood my ground with them, and I refused to let them intimidate me.
Take to the streets. Lift up your voice. Fight for your life while you still have a choice. Tell them nobody's body but mine.
Robin suffered post-traumatic stress and near kidney failure after her four-day ordeal. Fortunately for Robin, she received immediate medical attention when she arrived in Colorado. Not all prisoners are so lucky.
It was a nightmare. CCA doesn't, if you're on medication, I have a horrible seizure disorder. They didn't care.
Jane was convicted on a forgery charge and sent to a Nashville jail owned by CCA, the Corrections Corporation of America.
I was seizing, and my roommate was beating on the door. This girl's up here seizing. They told me about this. I don't remember it. And nobody comes because there's no guards anywhere around. They're way out in the hall somewhere. And you're in a cell in this big pod, and the buttons that you push for help don't work. I busted my head open, broke a tooth, bit my tongue. And she said I laid there an hour and a half before anybody even came. They handcuffed and shackled me. I told them I was fixing to seize. Don't do this. Don't take me down those steps. They said, you're going down the steps. And I started seizing, and they just let me fall. And they carried me to the hospital in handcuffs and shackles. Seizing. It cracked my wrist. So it's not a good place.
The state of prison health care is generally poor. Escalating medical expenses have put pressure on all prisons to cut costs. In private prisons, cost-cutting is particularly rampant. Reporter Alex Friedman served time at a Tennessee prison owned by CCA. Friedman says CCA had signed an incentive contract at his prison as a way of reducing medical expenses.
The contract that CCA entered into was that if this doctor could reduce medical costs for inmates at the prison, they would increase his salary. So the more he saved on inmate medical care, the more he got paid. You provide fewer prescription medications for inmates who need them. You do fewer consultations to outside doctors, specialists, for whatever medical care that's needed. The way that you save money is that you provide less care.
State and county prisons are also searching for ways to cut medical expenses. Many of these prisons are now farming out prisoner health care to private providers. For-profit companies now provide 40% of all inmate medical care. Several states and counties have turned over their entire prison systems to private health care companies. Pueblo County in Colorado contracted with Management Team Solutions to provide medical services for its jails. State Public Defender Doug Wilson says the MTS cost-cutting measures had caused a drastic reduction in adequate health care for some of his clients.
We just started getting kites are the way inmates communicate with us. Kite after kite after kite about, I'm not getting my meds, I've got diabetes, and they're not checking my blood sugar. We have pregnant women, no prenatal care, no ultrasound, no, absolutely no medical care whatsoever. And we just saw horror story after horror story after horror story.
Cutting costs means reductions in staffing levels as well as services. Terry Coopers is a psychiatrist who has observed reductions in prisoner mental health care firsthand. Coopers has visited both private and government-run prisons.
As soon as a private company comes in, what they do is they end the psychiatrist's resident hours. That is, they don't have a psychiatrist available in the facility, but rather they put someone on call. The next thing I notice is the person who is on call rarely comes to the facility. So what's left is the nurse, who's usually not a psychiatric nurse, has someone with a psychiatric emergency and has no psychiatrist they can consult with. And I have seen this over and over again. Now, the private company that supplies the mental health services has saved a lot of money. But what's true is that the prisoners have gotten a whole lot less quality mental health care.
Less care and staffing can be dangerous, even lethal for prisoners. 10 inmates died recently in upstate New York. Their medical care was provided by the for-profit corporation Prison Health Services. A state investigation into their deaths revealed the same problems. Medical staffs trimmed to the bone, doctors underqualified or out of reach, prescription drugs withheld, and employee misconduct unpunished. Despite this questionable track record, Prison Health Services keeps winning new contracts and is now the country's largest for-profit healthcare provider. Government ethics expert Bruce Kane says when government services are delegated to the private sector, it's difficult to hold anyone accountable for problems that may arise later.
When you've delegated out to a bunch of private firms, nobody's ultimately accountable. It's, oh, well, they didn't do well, we'll go find another firm. The delegation severs the line of accountability that allows the public to say, well, you made a decision that caused these things to go awry, and we're going to kick you out of office. And you can't do that as easily when these things are delegated to private groups.
You're listening to Crime Pays, a look at who's getting rich from the prison boom, a radio documentary on prison privatization. I'm Joanne Marr. While prison privatization growth has been steady, opposition has been slow to build. In late 1999, grassroots leadership, a community activist group, started a national campaign against private prisons. It has organized a coalition of labor unions, churches, students, and activist groups. For many years, grassroots leadership and union groups have set up a picket line outside CCA's annual shareholders meeting in Nashville.
It doesn't work. It's not moral. It violates our sense of ethics. It's time to get rid of private prisons.
Cy Khan is Grassroots Leadership's executive director.
Grassroots Leadership is a very small organization. Here we are taking on a multi-billion dollar industry. But I believe that we will win. People of conscience, people of faith, people with ethical backbone will say no to private prisons. I am so heartened that 48 Roman Catholic bishops have signed a pastoral statement that says, this is immoral. This is contrary to our teaching. It cannot be allowed to exist. I am enormously heartened that the Presbyterian Church USA adopted a resolution that says this is contrary to our religious beliefs. Not only are private prisons not working, costing us money rather than saving us money, but that they are compromising our souls. We are diminished by our participation in a system that imprisons human beings for profit.
These days, pockets of community opposition have begun to emerge whenever a private prison project is being proposed.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you shall give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please state your name and address.
At this public hearing in Pueblo, Colorado, the city council was considering a proposal by the GEO Group, formerly known as Wackenhut Corrections.
My name is Terry Stewart. I live at 105 36th Lane, an eighth of a mile from proposed prison. In the 25 days since the announcement was made, we the citizens have gathered over 475 signatures, not only from residents of the county, but also residents of the city of Pueblo. I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is, what's the rush? Why is this now on the fast track?
Terry Stewart and Steve Wilson own farms just across the road from the proposed prison site. A CCA prison in nearby Olney Springs was recently shut down following a prison riot. This makes Steve Wilson nervous about a new private prison so close to his home.
It's not what we look forward to. And, of course, you know, I got my daughter next to me, my folks next to, right next to me, my daughter's two houses down, and then my wife and all the grandkids and everybody. They're all concerned, you know, and here you got to try to calm their nerves a little bit and tell them things will be okay, and it's just disrupted a whole lot. My folks are real elderly, and, you know, people in the city, what they got to understand is if something isn't right, you can sell your house and go buy another house. Farm, you just don't go sell a farm. It's just, you know, it happens, but it's not like, oh, boy, we're upset, we're mad, now we're just go buy another farm somewhere. That just don't happen. There's too much invest of your life into an area where you live like this, and to just sell and leave, it's heartbreaking to even think about that.
Stand up for your rights. Come on, get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Steve Wilson is just one of many people now questioning the need to build more prisons.
We all are here because we love where we came from. We're here because we love our schools.
At this rally in Sacramento, California, hundreds of students and teachers gathered at the state capitol to protest cuts in education. California State Assembly member Jackie Goldberg spoke at the rally and said that the growing corrections budget is taking away too much money from the schools.
Why are we spending $25,000 to $50,000 a year to put someone in jail and $7,000 to educate them? My God, rather than sending you to jail if you screw up, we should send you to Harvard for the $35,000. You'd do a whole lot better.
Come on. Say education, not incarceration.
Education, not spending on state prisons has now reached an all-time high of $40 billion a year, more than four times greater than 10 years ago. With the recent economic recession, almost every state has had to make cuts in correction spending. Rehabilitation, once a dirty word, is back in vogue, along with drug treatment and early release programs. Dan Wilhelm is director with the Vera Institute of Justice, an organization that promotes corrections reform.
I'd say that about half the states have done something over the last legislative session or two, probably closer to 30 states or so, to pass some sort of statutory measure to ameliorate the harshness of criminal penalties. And that really does run the gamut from repealing mandatory minimums to creating better alternatives to incarceration on what people call the front end, beefing up probation instead of just having one solution, which is to send an offender to the most expensive resource in the system, which is a hard prison bed.
Fewer prison beds means less demand and less profits for private prisons. Following the bad publicity from the Youngstown scandal and CCA's near bankruptcy, the number of private prisons started declining in 2001. Just as things were looking bleak for the private prison industry, the federal government came to its rescue.
The only force powerful enough to stop the rise of tyranny and terror and replace hatred with hope is the force of human freedom.
The war on terror has meant a crackdown on immigrants and new opportunities for private prisons. The federal prison system is now overflowing with foreign detainees, immigrants overstaying their visas or committing crimes. Private prisons are more than willing to build new immigrant detention facilities.
Probably the biggest growth area for private prisons right now is the federal government.
Private prison spokesperson Scott Marquardt.
President Bush has indicated he's not willing to build any more federal prisons and is expecting to use private facilities, private beds, to take up the increasing demand.
The head of Cornell Corporation on a stockholders conference call had made the statement at one point that 9/11 was good for business and that there was over 100,000 undocumented aliens in the United States of Middle Eastern descent.
Lance Corcoran, executive director of CCPOA, the California Corrections Officers Union.
And he was literally rubbing his hands together, hoping to get a portion of that market share. I think that is absolutely deplorable. And it really shows what their motivation is. It's not about public safety. It's not about public service. It's about money and what can be made. Again, they're much like a hotel or a cruise ship. As long as they keep those beds full, they're happy.
The war on terror has created new opportunities for private sector involvement in Iraq's prison system as well. Private contractors were part of the interrogation team at Abu Ghraib. They were also part of the Justice Department's team to help reconstruct Iraq's prison system. Prior to the Abu Ghraib scandal, there was talk of new supermax prisons in Iraq being managed by private prison companies.
Come on, friends, and let's go down, let's go down, let's go down. Come on, friends, and let's go down, down on the picket line.
Closer to home, grassroots leadership and its allies are continuing their fight against the spread of private prisons. Their recent campaign on college campuses forced the catering corporation Sodexo to end its investment partnership with CCA. In 2000, students staged marches, sit-ins, and food boycotts at several universities. A year later, Sodexo withdrew from CCA. Research analyst Kevin Pranis helped spearhead the campaign.
I think that the campaign was tremendously successful in terms of involving students around the country in really lifting up the debate around private prisons, but also the larger question of why so many people are in prison. Over 100 campuses easily participated in various ways in the Sodexo campaign. There was a lot of media attention as well. I think it was a great consciousness-raising tool.
We don't need no private prisons. Taking our money for profit.
While the Sodexo campaign represents a small victory for grassroots leadership, the private prison industry is far from dead.
It's clear right now that the industry is back after going through its worst period.
Research analyst Kevin Pranis.
The states have started expanding with private prisons, and I think the industry got together and became sort of more effective, figured out how to more effectively market itself after a lot of stumbling. And so you're seeing them coming back in a big way. And I think the truth is that as long as you have 2 million people in prison, I don't think you're going to get rid of private prisons. There's too many reasons for them to be there.
Criminal justice analyst Judy Green agrees that prison privatization is likely to continue as long as the prison population remains large.
They're not going to go away. We have many states that are still very dependent on them, still grappling with overcrowding problems, or they've privatized a third, upwards of a half of their population in states like New Mexico and Oklahoma. Private prisons have grown and prospered under the political will of legislators who have been both ideologically as well as financially see themselves benefiting from privatization. So until those folks decide they are better served by having public prisons, you know, we're going to live with this industry.
Will you wait for me while I do my time? Will you wait for me for 99?
Crime Pays, a look at who's getting rich from the prison boom, was produced and narrated by Joanne Marr. Funding for this program was provided by the Generoso Pope Foundation. Original music written and performed by Cy Khan. Thanks also to Grassroots Leadership for its assistance in making this program possible.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from St. John's Books, North Portland's full-service independent bookstore offering new and used books on progressive politics, literature, poetry, titles for kids, and more. St. John's Books is located at 8622 North Lombard in St. John's. Information at 503-283-0032 or via email at info@stjohnsbooks.com. Up next on Democracy Now!, hear an interview with a reporter from The Guardian about U.S. forces launching their largest military offensive in Afghanistan since the fall of the Taliban in late 2001. Also, a member of the United Teachers of New Orleans talks about how control of many Louisiana schools is being given to private charter organizations, and a look at the destruction of public housing units for the poor in New Orleans.